I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Today, Rabbi's guest is David Breifman, CEO of the Jewish Education Project, author of the new book, Heroism and Hope, Recharging Israel Education in a Post-October 7 World. We'll also have a visit from our resident expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. In honor of the 250th birthday month of the United States of America, we've been exploring the history of the Jews of America, the first nation, the United States, to guarantee us freedom of religion and include Jews as full citizens. The last few weeks, we've taken the story from the American Revolution to the beginning of the massive wave of Eastern European immigration of Ashkenazic Jews that transformed a relatively small American Jewish community of perhaps 200,000 into literally millions in less than 40 years. Jewish migration to the U.S. increased dramatically in the early 1880s as a result of horrible persecution and economic difficulties in much of Eastern Europe. Most of these new immigrants were Yiddish-speaking Ashkenazi Jews, arriving from poor diaspora communities of the Russian Empire and the Pale of Settlement, mostly located in modern-day Poland, Lithuania, Belarus, Ukraine, and Moldova. During that same period, large numbers of Ashkenazic Jews also arrived from Galicia, at that time the most impoverished region of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, with a heavy Jewish urban population. They were driven out mainly by economic reasons, but, well, there was plenty of anti-Semitic persecution mixed in. And many Jews also immigrated from Romania and Hungary. Over 2 million Jews landed in America between the late 19th century and 1924, when the Immigration Act of 1924 severely restricted immigration. Most Jews settled in the New York metropolitan area, establishing the world's major concentrations of Jewish population at the time. In 1915, the circulation of the daily Yiddish newspapers was 500,000 in New York City alone, 600,000 overall nationally. In addition, thousands more people subscribed to the numerous weekly papers and many magazines written in Yiddish. By 1920, Jews, who had been merely 0.5% of the American population at the time of the Civil War, made up 4% of the population of the U.S. That was probably the highest number we ever reached. The fact that many of those Jews were concentrated in New York and that concentrated population of Jews became citizens and voted in elections, well, that made the Jewish electorate suddenly an important part of American politics. At the beginning of the 1900s, newly arrived Jews built support networks. Many small synagogues and Landsmannschaften, country person associations for Jews from the same town or village. With the help of an ever-increasing number of Jewish charitable organizations, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, the Jewish Agency, settlement houses, young men and women, Hebrew associations, and many, many others, Jews quickly learned English, eagerly adopted American customs and habits, and became part of American life. As has been true throughout American Jewish history, Jews served in the U.S. military at a much higher rate than their presence in the population would seem to dictate. About 250,000 Jews served in World War I, 6% of the whole American World War I military, much higher than their 4% of the total population. That pattern would repeat in World War II. Over 500,000 Jews served in the American Armed Forces, far greater than our percentage of the American population. A startling number of Jews played important roles in the rapid development of the U.S. in the late 19th and early 20th century into a global power. It's impossible to do more than list some of the most influential. Among the Jews who helped America transform into an economic and cultural heavyweight on the world stage were Wall Street titan Jacob Schiff, founder of the investment firm Kuhn Loeb, who funded much of the development of the American railroad system. Schiff was also a tremendous philanthropist who supported a wide range of important Jewish causes. Julius Rosenwald created Sears Roebuck. He was by far the largest supporter of black literacy in America, building thousands of schools, a key supporter of the NAACP and the Urban League. Louis Brandeis was the first Jew ever appointed to the Supreme Court after a tremendous legal career fighting for free speech, labor law, and the right of privacy, all of which gave him the nickname the People's Lawyer. Samuel Gompers put the union movement on the map in America and transformed the rights of workers. Irving Berlin wrote the most patriotic songs of all time while creating wildly popular show music. Emma Lazarus wrote the great poem that's on the Statue of Liberty, and so on. Levi Strauss, well, he created blue jeans. Joseph Pulitzer ran much of the media. After his death, his will created the Pulitzer Prizes for Journalism. Jews were elected to Congress, the Senate, began to serve in the president's cabinet, too. You know, Irving Berlin put Emma Lazarus's great poem on the Statue of Liberty to music, and here he is, singing his own setting of that great poem by the Sephardic Jewish poet. It's called The New Colossus.
Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore. To me, I lift my lamp beside the golden door.
Kind of cool to be able to play Irving Berlin singing his own song on Too Jewish, isn't it? Emma Lazarus's poem in 1883 was called The New Colossus, and frankly, it's worth reading all of it here on Too Jewish. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, her name Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. America represented for so many immigrant Jews the golden land, the golden Medina, a place where Jews could be free and rise as far as their efforts would take them. It didn't always work out, of course, but very often it did. A major theater district developed on New York's Second Avenue, featuring plays and musicals in Yiddish. Some of these praised the amazing new land they found themselves in with all its warts. Here's a song called Leben soll Columbus from that Second Avenue theater world. Long life to Columbus. Drink a l'chaim to him. because he made it possible for us to come to America. But there was a dark side to American Jewish acceptance and increasing prominence in U.S. life. In 1915, a young businessman, Leo Frank, was lynched in Georgia for a crime he had not committed. The mob cared only that he was a Jew. While lynchings of Jews were rare, not so rare for blacks in the South in that period, the lynching of Leo Frank was so brutal and unjust it led to the creation of a very different kind of Jewish organization, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, nowadays called the ADL, which fought anti-Semitism and sought justice in cases of violence against Jews. While the U.S. government did not have any officially anti-Semitic policies or take any obviously anti-Semitic actions, nonetheless, bigotry, anti-Semitism, and Jew hatred always floated just beneath the surface in early to mid-20th century America, and sometimes there it was, right out in the open. During the 1920s, Henry Ford literally purchased the Dearborn Independent newspaper specifically to publish and popularize the anti-Semitic forgery produced by the Tsar of Russia's profoundly anti-Semitic secret police, the fraudulent Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Father Coughlin, a radio priest with a huge following in the 30s, regularly attacked Jews using the worst anti-Semitic slanders and lies he could. And prior to Pearl Harbor, the German-American Bund supported Hitler. There were sometimes street battles between Nazi supporters and Jewish toughs in America. Usually, the street-smart Jewish hoodlums and gangsters won those easily. Then, as now, isolationists and America First types found ways to blame the Jews for compelling America to look beyond its borders and take a leadership role in a very troubled world. They made sure that when the Nazis began to murder Jews, the doors of America were closed. During World War II, Jews didn't know the U.S. military could have bombed the train lines going into Auschwitz and certainly could have publicized the horrors of the Holocaust much earlier, but chose not to do so. Some of that was simple anti-Semitism. Jews were prominent in FDR's administration during the Depression and World War II. In general, American Jews felt very American. About 500,000 American Jews, half of all Jewish males between the ages of 18 and 50, fought in World War II in every theater and with great distinction. And when the boys and girls came home as men and women veterans of the Army and Navy, they were not simply going to accept being anything less than full first-class citizens of the United States. Anti-Semitism be damned. Well, my friends, we have now navigated Jewish life in America up to the end of World War II, more or less. There'll be a bit more to tell in next week's show. That, by the way, will be our 24th anniversary show of Too Jewish. Don't miss it. Meanwhile, today is now. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. David Breifman is the Chief Executive Officer of the Jewish Education Project, a national organization innovating in Jewish education. And they have a new project about Israel education, which we'd like to talk about. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Great to be here.
First of all, tell us what the Jewish Education Project is.
Well, the Jewish Education Project actually began as the Board of Jewish Education, or the Bureau of Jewish Education, all the way back in the Lower East Side over 100 years ago, and it was a local organization. But recently, and with the advent of technology, it became a more national organization, which basically offers curriculum and professional development for all Jewish educators now around North America and, in fact, the entire world.
The focus of Jewish education in America, particularly non-Orthodox Jewish education, in my view, as a rabbi, a congregational rabbi, educator, and so on for a long time, has been Israel, the Holocaust, and of late, anti-Semitism. Sometimes it seems like those are the only things we talk about with our kids. Is that a mistake?
Well, you know, it's an important point that you actually make. And the first thing to just to say there is that all education needs to be developmentally appropriate. So even some of those topics you mentioned, when you're talking with really young kids, I'm not sure you're exploring all of those things as your point of major concern. And in general, as the kids get older, you start exploring some of these, you know, more complicated or difficult issues. But the one thing that I say to all of my staff and all the educators that we interact with is that, yes, it's true that issues relating to anti-Semitism are prevalent and the current situation in Israel is cause for concern. But if we don't lead with Jewish joy and Jewish pride and what it means to be an active member of a really engaging Jewish tradition, then there's no point talking about the other stuff as well. So I always say we lead with the Jewish joy. We make it really compelling and why it's so valuable for our young people, especially to be engaged with Jewish life. And then we can start dealing with some of the more complicated issues that we confront in our day-to-day lives.
You could have delivered my sermon last Friday night. I think that's...
Well, I didn't go down the rabbinic path. I'll leave that to you.
It's okay. Israel education is a very important, central part of the way we've expressed our Judaism everywhere in the world. It has become more complicated in recent years. Tell us what prompted this sort of reexamination of Israel education.
So the first thing that I would say is that your assumption that Israel has always been a central part of Jewish education might be part and parcel of some institutions, but it's not ubiquitous. And one of the things we want to actually say is that, yes, in order to be a fully engaged Jew in the world today, that Israel does need to be integral to all comprehensive forms of Jewish education. So that's the starting point for most of our, you know, for most of the way we look at this. And, you know, Israel is everywhere. It's in our Bible. It's in our, you know, it's in our zeitgeist. It's in the news. But it's all around what it means to be a Jew in the world today. So that's the important piece. You know, developing a connection with a land far away is not easy.
Right.
And when we say we want to make it integral, we try and look at all avenues, whether it's through the Passover Seder or the Shabbat prayers or whatever it might be. They're your first points of connection. But as kids get older, their first points of connection are often through media and, you know, more commonly now social media. So we're dealing with different issues today than perhaps when you and I were growing up and first encountering Israel.
We will talk much more with David Breifman, the head of the Jewish Education Project, about Jewish education generally and in particular Israel education. We come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established 7.5 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the Metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests always in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. Religious school is signing kids up now. It's for school-age children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Torah Tykes experience, Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with terrific Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to sign up now. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Come in person. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m., filled with music, always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can also come to services on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson, or our Adult Education Academy classes, always live and on Zoom. Access them through the website, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, and Torah Tykes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the recurrence, surge of anti-Semitism in America, all around the world, among young people, and everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. We've both been in the position of teaching young people, and it raises the very important question, how do we try to address that kind of situation, the situation we find ourselves in now, in which anti-Semitism has been normalized on the far right, on the far left. There are places you can't get elected to office unless you condemn Israel and say it's part of a Zionist colonial enterprise to take over the world, that kind of stuff. I've always thought that the best way to deal with this kind of hatred is to have close relations with people, to respect them, to understand their tradition, and have them understand your own tradition. And I've worked for that throughout my career. I'm not sure that's enough now.
Well, particularly because increasingly, tragically, because of all the Arab money that's behind this and their very skillful use of media, particularly social media, a lot of young Jews have become, if not anti-Semitic, certainly anti-Zionist in a virulent and sometimes violent way. And, you know, I think charity begins at home. I mean, I think the first thing we have to address is how do we prevent young Jews from falling for all these lies, all these outrageous claims that Israel's always responsible, and therefore the international Jewish conspiracy is responsible, and therefore you should hate yourself and keep a low profile and not wear McCain David or anything else, whatever. I mean, there's a whole maelstrom of evil stuff that we thought was dead and buried, but we were wrong. And there's so much sophistication in this effort nowadays that it's almost self-perpetuating now. I mean, I don't think it all comes from Doha.
Although a lot of the funding may, we have, I think, failed in an interesting way in the United States, in the Jewish community of the United States. I been part of it, although I've often fought against it. I've seen a Jewish community which has substantial resources, putting those resources many places, but not a whole lot of it into youth education, and in particular, failing to understand that the university is the key battleground of ideas for young people in America. We kind of were always told in congregational life, well, that's Hillel's turf, you know, and let Hillel do it. And I appreciate everything that Hillel does, but it's a good institution. It's on most major campuses all around the country. But it engages a small percentage of even the Jewish students. And it hasn't been terribly effective at countering what has been an avalanche of, boy, just conspiratorial, non-factual, anti-Jewish press that has poured out. And to say that, oh, it's Israel's fault is kind of preposterous, because Israel has a right to exist. You don't see this kind of criticism of any other nation. And I recently quoted Sam Harris, who's an atheist. we don't agree theologically at all, but he was criticized for not joining the anti-Israel parade. And he said, you need to compare it to what would happen if the Palestinians had power that Israel has. And you cannot tell me, I'm sure Israel's not perfect, but the evil on the other side is so profound that it's utterly destructive, and you can't possibly compare it. And yet people laud that evil. So I actually think a huge campaign on university campuses is critical, and it should be funded at that level, not the way we've been kind of putting our resources.
Right. I think earlier in the education we give young people in Hebrew school, and those very few who go to Hebrew high, whatever, I mean, so that they arrive at university well-armed, well-prepared to stand their ground and not be sort of seduced by this now populist rhetoric, and get a sense of belonging to a universal movement. The universal movement is opposing Israel, or even worse, opposing Jews, opposing Jewish existence and Jewish continuity. We're in trouble.
You know, I've heard people say this feels like Germany in the 1930s. It doesn't. I think that's wrong. But it doesn't feel good right now. I think we definitely need to change our priorities and focus much more on younger people, because we're not going to win the social media battle with people, frankly, Tom, our age.
Right. Yeah, we don't have a clue how to use social media.
Not the way our kids do, not the way our grandchildren do. Tom, thanks so much. Hopefully we'll have happier subjects to discuss soon.
Here's to that.
Talk to you soon.
Look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Is this Rabbi Steinberg? Yes. This is the IRS. Yes. Do you have a congregant named Milton Siegel? Yes. Did he donate $1 million to your temple? He will. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Two Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Have you heard about the new movement in Judaism? It's not Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, Reconstructionist, or Renewal. It's called Cardiac Jews. You know, I'm Jewish in my heart. Well, we usually think of this as a kind of abdication, meaning I'm Jewish in my heart, but I don't do anything about it in my actual life. There is one sense in which being called a cardiac Jew can have real meaning. In the middle of our weekly Torah portion of Akev, a great question gets asked. What does the Lord your God ask of you? That you have awe of the Lord your God and walk in all of God's ways and love God and serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. But it then follows this wonderful spiritual and moral instruction with a puzzling passage telling us to do something physically impossible. We are commanded to circumcise the foreskin of our hearts. This is a new kind of Brit Milah that smacks of flat-out self-murder. Circumcise our hearts? How do you do that with a flint knife on top of an Aztec temple? How could that possibly relate to the moral commandments we've been given in this portion of Akev, which form the core of our Deuteronomic covenantal connection to an ethical God? If we were to do that actual act, circumcising the heart, cutting off a flap of this essential human organ, we would, of course, die, no matter how skilled the moil was. It must be a metaphor, right? In fact, this passage defines the fact that Torah was never meant to be read literally. It makes it very clear that Torah is and always was a teaching device to create and focus moral and spiritual direction, not a simplistic piece of ancient lore intended to be taken literally. So what does this metaphor mean? It means that to truly love God and walk in God's ways and serve God and to love our fellow human beings, we have to change. Circumcise the foreskin of your hearts teaches us to open our hearts to God, to holiness, to goodness. In order to be able to do what God asks in the ethical covenant of Deuteronomy, we must cut away a certain layer that exists protecting us. We must remove the hard casing we construct over our innate humanity, the armor of ego and self-interest and self-importance that build up out of our insecurity or out of overconfidence. We must find a way to cut away the arrogance of the eternal critic, the cool hostility of the perpetual cynic. We must remove the snide pleasure of a circulator of Lashon Hara, the self-righteous anger of the eternally injured. We must take our heads out of the equation for a bit, shut off the controlling negativity of the brain, and allow our hearts to express the depth of feeling and empathy within them. It's a kind of spiritual Brit Milah that Akev is teaching. Because when we remove that hard casing around our hearts, when we perform this spiritual Milah, we change ourselves for the better. Then we can open our hearts and feel and know that God is good and desires good, that what God truly wants is something we can offer. That the various ways Akev advocates exploring how to fulfill God's desires are really no more than a means of creating good in the world. One path of kindness, ethics, and personal respect. That's the heart of the matter. This is the true lesson of the heart. On this coming Shabbat and over the coming week, may we each learn to listen to our own hearts, to get our heads out of the way long enough to touch the holiness implanted within each of us. Then we might become truly cardiac Jews, Jews in our hearts, leading us to become truly Jewish in the best way, in all the other aspects of our lives. When we return in a moment on Two Jewish, our guest, David Breifman, the CEO of the Jewish Education Project and author of the new book, Heroism and Hope, Recharging Israel Education in a Post-October 7th World, tells us what we are doing right and wrong in Jewish education these days and teaches us how to improve on both counts. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world, with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
Reed College in Oregon agreed to a host of far-reaching institutional changes, including agreeing that targeting Jewish Zionists will now be considered discriminatory, all of that in order to settle multiple federal anti-Semitism investigations. Parties to the complaint announced these settlements last week. Settlement was announced by the ADL and the Brandeis Center for Human Rights under law, which jointly filed the complaint under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act that prohibits discrimination in any institution receiving federal funds. This comes as campuses across the country facing threats of losing federal funding under the Trump administration have demonstrated a new willingness to negotiate anti-Semitism protections. As part of the agreement, the private Portland, Oregon liberal arts school says it will insert language into discrimination policy, asserting that for many people, Zionism is integral to their religious, ancestral, and/or ethnic Jewish identity, and that targeting Jews on the basis of their Zionist identity will be considered discriminatory. The school will also contract a third-party consultant to monitor and report its effectiveness in adhering to anti-Semitism protections, a role that is unusual in similar Title VI agreements. This agreement says Reed College will consider the International Holocaust Remembrance Association's working definition of anti-Semitism that permits some criticism of Israel, but will implement anti-Semitism training for all faculty and staff. We take concerns about anti-Semitism and all forms of unlawful discrimination seriously. We will continue to support the well-being, safety, and success of every member of our community, a Reed College spokesperson said. Reed did not comment further. The resolution stems from two anonymous Title VI anti-Semitism complaints from Jewish former Reed students, both filed in 2024 during the Biden administration. One of those cases related to a student whose dorm room mezuzah was vandalized and who herself was pelted with rocks during a pro-Palestinian terrorist demonstration at Reed in the spring of 2024. That student later left the school out of concern for her own safety. Both of the acts would have already been considered violations of school policy for reasons unrelated to the student's Jewish and Zionist identity. Brandeis's Katz Prober argued both should also have been considered in the context of her targeting by anti-Zionist activists. In Israel, Gadi Eisenkot's Yashar Party, a new party, would emerge as the largest faction in the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, if elections were held now. It would win 24 seats, according to a poll published last week in Israel. That poll asked respondents if elections for the Knesset were held today, which party would you vote for? It found that Eisenkot remained the preferred candidate for prime minister, well ahead of the current prime minister, Bibi Netanyahu. According to the poll, the distribution of seats between the various blocs remained unchanged from recent surveys. Opposition parties received 59 seats, 51 for the current coalition. Adding the Arab party's 10 seats would bring the opposition total to 69 against the current government. Without the Arab party's support, however, neither bloc can reach the 61-seat majority required to form a new government. Eisenkot continues to lead Netanyahu in the question of the suitability for prime minister. He receives 43% support from Israelis, unchanged from recent weeks. Netanyahu gets just 37%. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. David Breifman is the Chief Executive Officer of the Jewish Education Project, a national organization of long standing dedicated to innovation in Jewish education and helping Jewish educators in day schools, synagogue settings, camp settings, really all aspects of Jewish education. You know, I wonder, from your 360-degree view, what's the state of Jewish education in America right now?
It's a great question, and it really depends on who you ask and also depends on where you're located. Some people ask that question, and when they think about Jewish education, all they're really thinking about is Jewish day schools, and if they're more Orthodox, maybe yeshivot as well. And in that case, it really depends on which city you're located in and what community you're based in or associated with. Our understanding of Jewish education is far broader than Jewish day schools. We talk about Jewish education taking place in formal and informal settings. It takes place in congregations, in Jewish camps, in JCCs, in early childhood centers, adult Jewish learning. And the surprising statistic that you might want to like just think about for all of your listeners is that there are probably more Jews today engaged in Jewish learning than at any other time in history. And that's largely because they're doing it online. So when you're talking about the state of Jewish education in general, it really depends on where you want to hone in on. I happen to be really, really greedy. So whatever percentage I tell you of kids and young people involved in Jewish education, I want more of them involved. I want it to be better and more compelling and have higher retention rates. But in general, we're not in a bad place. We're not in a great place. But Jewish education is still holding its own and doing pretty well in most communities around the country.
In exploring Israel education in particular, one of the focuses of a new initiative, you have to look and see what's out there and then decide what's missing or what needs to be improved. If you were to look at how Jewish educational institutions are addressing the subject of Israel now, what would be your kind of general comment and what needs to improve?
Yeah, so in general, I'd make two comments there. One is that for many of us, it seems that Israel education has been reactive for many years. It's on the back burner. We're celebrating Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel Independence Day. We're doing an Israel Day at camp, or, you know, a slight focus on it in our Hebrew schools. And then something major happens in the Middle East, and all of a sudden we focus on trying to, you know, react to the events that have taken place. So the first thing that I would say is, for Israel education to be effective, it needs to be proactive rather than reactive. And the second theme that I'm seeing is that there are a whole lot of adults in the Jewish world today who would really like their children and the young people in their communities to think, believe, and feel about Israel just the same way that they do. And
yeah,
that's a misconception in so many ways because, you know, as adults, we've all had our own life experiences, our own educational experiences to help us formulate our own connections with Israel. So our job as educators and as a community isn't to make young people be more like us. It's actually to offer them more educational opportunities so that they can develop their own sense of connection with Israel, even if it might end up being slightly different to yours or the people around you in the adult, the so-called adult community.
The so-called adult community. I like that. In looking at the way young people are experiencing the general mood about Israel now, which has become so charged and often quite hostile, particularly when kids get to college, a lot of the organized Jewish community has been focused on Jewish education, you know, up through Bar Mitzvah, then maybe a little bit after, and then we just kind of step out. How do you see those adolescent college years and early adult years as an opportunity for Jewish education, and particularly for Israel education?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you the example that I talk about quite a lot, and that is that many young Jews who do so-called graduate or complete their Jewish education at the age of Bar or Bat Mitzvah, firstly, that's a mistake and an error and something that we as a Jewish community need to rectify and make more appealing to retain them much longer than the age of 12 or 13. But in general, if you're a Jewish kid in a public school or an independent school, and you're putting your head down and you don't want to be known as a Jewish kid in your classroom, you're quite happy just being one of the other Americans in the room. A strange phenomenon happened for many, many decades that Jewish educators spoke about behind closed door, and that was called the Anne Frank moment. And that was the time in the classroom when the English or the social studies teacher brought out the diary of Anne Frank to study, and then the kid, the Jewish kid who was trying to keep their head below the water, not being noticed, all of a sudden everyone in the class turned to that Jewish kid and said, "So, what do you think? What's your special connection with this particular book? How do you relate to Anne Frank differently to we do?" And that was called, we called it the Anne Frank moment. And why I mention that is because in many schools now, middle schools and high schools and colleges around the campus, around the country, the kids who were trying to remain below the radar, after October 7th, a similar thing happened. And whether they wanted to or not, whether they were trying to be identifiably Jewish or not, other people turned to them after October 7th, whether it was in a social studies class or a geography class or a political science class, and started talking to those Jewish kids and asked them, "So, what do you think about the Jewish state or your country or about your homeland?" And so, in a way, whether we liked it or not, and we had to confront this, that Jewish kids were put on the spot and had to make some decisions and had to either work out, do I know enough? Don't I know enough? How am I going to respond? Am I not going to respond? And so this moment of October 7th really uncovered some shortcomings in Jewish education and life in general. But I think what we've actually seen is really an important resurgence in the number of Jewish kids who are actively interested in knowing more. Now, the media highlights the Jewish kids who might be turning against the so-called establishment and siding with the so-called other side. But that's actually not what we're seeing. We're seeing a resurgence in interest, many kids getting involved in all aspects of Jewish and Israel life. It might not be the same way as that you and I grew up, but remember, these kids are growing up in a different environment. They don't live with the knowledge or the mindset of forget 1967 or 73, the Yom Kippur War and the Six Day War. They don't know about Oslo. They don't know about peace process. They've only known one type of Israeli government in their lifetime, with a couple of years of exceptions. So
right.
It's a different context which they're growing up in. So to think that they're responding differently than you or I might have, I think that's pretty normal.
Saying it's normal is certainly true. Jewish education is nothing if not cultivating questioning and difference and argument. I mean, the Talmud is 66 volumes of arguments, right?
Yeah, exactly.
In the course of innovating in Jewish education, how much pushback do you tend to get from the institutions you work with?
The biggest pushback we get is from adults who feel really uncomfortable with young people coming out the other side of that educational experience, whatever that might mean, with an opinion differing to theirs. And I got news to every adult and every parent and every grandparent. Like, that's normal. And if you tell a young person what they must believe and what they must think, there's a pretty good chance they're going to revolt and come out thinking something differently, even if it's just to annoy you. Young people need to be exposed to multiple narratives, diverse perspectives, differing opinions, and as long as they've got enough information that we're giving them, that they're going to reach their own conclusions. So the biggest pushback we get is the risk factor that because we're offering multiple experiences and multiple perspectives, the kids might come out thinking or feeling something different. But we basically turn around and say, that happens to be what we call good education. And for an enduring identity to be achieved, it's only going to happen when young people reach their own conclusions, not when it's superimposed by someone else. So the biggest pushback we get is like, who are you to be telling them about perspectives that we don't agree with? And we say, better us tell them about those perspectives than them finding out about those perspectives for the first time in a possibly antagonistic environment at high school or college level. Can I give you one example just to make it really clear here? Is that many of our Jewish institutions celebrate Yom HaTzmaut, Israel Independence Day. And our kids go through their entire Jewish experiences at Hebrew school and day schools and summer camps, at Hillel, celebrating Israel Independence Day. And then all of a sudden they get to another situation and someone talks to them about Nakba, the Arab name for catastrophe, actually talking about precisely the same events of 1947-48, but from the alternative Palestinian perspective. And our kids are like, shocked, surprised. Why didn't anyone tell me about this? And our message to educators is basically like, better they hear about terms like Nakba in the safe environment of a good, solid Jewish educational experience, in the safety of where they're able to like deal with the dissonance rather than hear it first in an antagonistic or confrontational way.
Tell us about your book, Heroism and Hope, Recharging Israel Education in a Post-October 7th World.
Yeah, so the book that I wrote was part of my own cathartic experience of trying to grapple with what I had been through in the last 2.5 years, now coming up on 3 years since October 7th.
Right.
And then I realized pretty quickly into the writing process that I was talking about a whole lot of issues that were resonant with other Jewish educators as well. But more importantly, what I was trying to do in the book is bring out into the open, into the Jewish public discourse, many of the issues that we were talking about as educators behind closed doors, and giving other people, other stakeholders, clergy, parents, lay leadership, foundations, federations, something that they could actually hold and read and pick up a chapter at a time maybe and say, you know what, this is a real issue that we need to grapple with, because the way we used to do Jewish education or Israel education or simply telling young people what they need to know and do as a result of Israel education, that wasn't working. And October 7th opened up a whole new opportunity for us to actually do better education. And one of the mantras of the book is that all good Jewish education must be good Israel education, which also must be good education. And I wanted to give educational language to what we need right now as a community. I'll give you one of the starkest examples of that is that I don't believe that the organized Jewish community or the adults in the Jewish community are behaving very well right now. I think they're talking to each other with disrespect. They're name calling. They're excommunicating or trying to excommunicate. They're using absolutely foul and disrespectful language, creating red lines and barriers which are pushing people out of communal life. And in Jewish educational context, you can't do that. We need to be better than that. And therefore, I need to give educators enough strength to be able to say, if you want to be part of this Jewish learning community, you are more than welcome. My ground rules are simple. My ground rules are you have to respect other people. You cannot, you know, incite violence. You cannot try to kick somebody out of that bunk or that classroom. I still have ground rules, but more importantly, I've got education, which says that we must respect learners no matter where they are or where they find themselves, and then try and take them on a journey to gain more insight so they can become more empowered and committed Jews and more committed Israel experts or Zionists, however you want to frame it, as they develop.
Great words. Completely agree. It reminds me of when my mom's dad was in Cheder in the old country, and he liked to ask smart aleck questions. And so the Rebbe said, Shegetz, Fregnish, Kein Kashis, you know, don't ask any questions. And it's just turned him off for Jewish education for the rest of his life.
That is the worst possible thing we can do, I think, as Jewish educators, but also for rabbis as well, is turn someone away from Jewish life. It's not, the worst thing is not that they disagree with you. The worst thing is not they have an opinion which you actually dislike or find abhorrent. Like, Yilan and Shammai were the experts in not only listening to one another, but actually elevating the alternative opinion.
Right, right.
Our worst thing is actually kicking people away or turning them away.
Yeah, the worst thing is when they walk away. David, I want to thank you for a great visit. His book is called Heroism and Hope, Recharging Israel Education in a Post-October 7th World. Where can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about the organization and your book?
Yeah, JewishEdProject.org is the best place to find out about our organization. There you can link to our Reimagining Israel Education framework and process. And if you go on Amazon and you look up Breifman and Heroism and Hope, you're going to find a copy of the book right there that you can purchase.
Thank you so much. And we'll have to do this again because it surely is an important topic and can't believe I haven't done it till now. Thank you so much.
We'd love to.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. That one will be our 24th anniversary show, believe it or not. Our guest will be Dr. Anna Goldenberg, trauma surgeon who brought new surgical techniques to Israel during the recent war, featured in a new documentary called The Asset. Join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, each Friday night. Services in Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too. 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush, all led by me, live in person and on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for our service and class schedule to sign up for our Torah Tykes membership. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from Israel. Adir Getz's song, My Luck, Et HaMazal Sheli. My friends, may you have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.
יש רגעים שהזמן לא ישטוף עד הנצח איך נשקתי אותך על המצח שני ילדים סופרים כוכבים שוכבים על הדשא יש רגעים שאני לא מאמין איך זכיתי בתפילות עד כל מה שרציתי שתי נשמות הלילה הופכות להיות לאחת זוכרת לא ויתם גם כשהגשם דפק בחלום זוכרת איך נלחם והנה תראי אותנו היום אז אהבה שלי כל העולם שלי הם יש רגעים מסתכל עלייך כשאת נרדמת ורואה אותך זאת שמגדלת לנו את הילדים רצים וקופצים שוברים את הבית זוכרת לא ויתם גם כשהגשם דפק בחלום
זוכרת איך נלחמנו, והנה תראי אותנו היום.